I'm Laura. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Chris for asking me to speak here. Never been to this meeting, so it's fun and exciting for me. Sorry I didn't dress. I came from basketball, which I'm from, just to clear it up, the accent's from Arkansas. So, like, people from Mississippi Delta, like where I'm from, we like to dress for things. So I feel a little out of my element. My sobriety date is June the 29th, 1995. When I got sober, I was 21 years old and 4 months. So I have had a legal drink. It wasn't really celebrated because, you know, I hear a lot and see a lot, like, kids celebrate turning 21 as like a rite of passage. But I had already been dealing drugs for like 10 years. So, like, you don't take your drug dealer to get a shot and celebrate his 21st birthday. At least the people I was working with didn't. So I didn't, there wasn't really like a break where all of a sudden it was legal, because I was, like, by the time I turned 21, I was bottoming out. So I was, and for me, that meant that I was a bad drug dealer, and so I was broke, and I was scraping up, like, pennies and nickels off the sidewalk in Boston and trading them in for 40s, so that wasn't very celebratory. I got sober then, and have stayed sober, like, straight through, like, no breaks for holidays. No, you know, breaks for when I feel bad, breaks for when somebody dies or I lose a lover, like, none of that. And I'll put the message kind of up front in case you want to daydream. But so the way I've done that, like, is really simple. I've gotten a home group. I've done service at the home group. I've had a sponsor. I've had a sponsee ever since I worked the steps, and I worked the steps. And that's it. Like, and I've done that really consistently for 18 years now. I'm 40 years old, so I don't technically qualify for this meeting. Back when I did, I didn't really come to young people's, because I got sober up in Boston, and I went to the gay meetings because the young people's meetings were really straight for me, and I felt more like them, even though I felt I was 21 and they were like average age, maybe 45 and up. Like, yeah, I felt more like them than I felt like young people. I hadn't really felt young kind of ever. And there was this, like, young energy in the young people's meetings. Everybody, like, what did everyone scream together? Like, it's some kind of cult in there? Like, there was too much, like, group reciting and huggy stuff. And, like, I just, woo, it was too much for me. So to back up a little bit, because I think what a pitch is supposed to be is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And hopefully if I stay on those lines, we'll get a little experience, strength, and hope in it. So what it was like for me, you know, alcohol was like a food group in my household, like, and one that we loved. I mean, we all did it every day. And I grew up in the middle of nowhere, Arkansas, and my father invented guns and ammunition for a living. And we were a really scary family, and I was probably like 5'7" when I was 8. Like, so I was like a big, scary kid who had a gun, and lots of them. And my folks were not really good at providing for us, as you might guess. So I had a friend that I met. My mother had a female lover in Memphis, and so we would go to Memphis on the weekends, and she would just sort of set us free. And some of that, we were in a really conservative church, and that was the best place to sell drugs to the kids. And I met another drug dealer, and you know, that's what I did. I mean, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm here for my drinking. But if I don't talk about drugs, I can't talk about what I did for a living growing up. So it doesn't make sense for me not to do that. I can't tell you what it was like if I don't tell you that, you know, when I was 8 years old, I decided not to ever do heroin because I saw someone die in front of me, and she had a kid who was starving right next to her, and it made an impression. And that was what my childhood was like. So when I got here and people said, and by the way, my drunk dad used to beat the hell out of me every day, like literally every day. I was in a family where there was blood on the walls. So when I got here and older people than me said, "You are so lucky that you got sober young," I felt like, man, I wish you could be as lucky as me, because, you know, like it hasn't been. I didn't get here because things were good, you know, like I it wasn't like a lonely Tuesday. Like I was dying, you know. I did not have more time. And because I was really clear about that, like I did not have more time. Because I was clear about that, I was able to take the first step, though, you know, all that queer-hating Christianity made me hate God in return. And I came in here an atheist, and I really resisted coming to AA at all. I got sober up in Boston on RomneyCare, and he sent me to acupuncture twice a day, and I had like a therapist and stuff. And I used to lie about going to meetings because I saw God all over the steps, and I figured the steps must be the program since they're in the front of every book, and I just wasn't going to have any part of it. The catalyst that got me sober. When I was 21, I made my way up to Boston. I was going to music school there, and I was just having a couple beers on the roof. And when I decided to go back inside, I walked the wrong way and I walked off the roof, and I fell three stories and landed on my head. And I had gotten to, you know, they say that like first stage alcoholism, you're kind of building a tolerance. Second stage, you've got a huge tolerance. Third stage, kind of the tolerance is gone. And I had kind of gotten to third stage because I didn't think it was a heavy drinking night at all for me. You know, I was drinking every day and I just had a few beers. In fact, I was still there because I'd made a decision not to go out partying because I had to work in the morning. So, I tried to walk back into my place, and I was so wasted that I fell three stories, landed on my head, and did not know I was hurt. Until I looked in my hand, it was covered with blood. And, like, for me, that's just another head wound, which was just sort of another Tuesday for me. And I was having that summer, like, moments of clarity where, you know, it occurred to me that I was thousands of miles from home, and I was still getting hurt. And, you know, this was not my father's fault. I was not going to use that moment of clarity to get sober. What I was going to do, though, I had just started seeing someone, and I wanted this relationship to work. I wasn't real good at relationships, and I wanted this one to work. And so I had made an appointment with a shrink the next day. So here I trot into the shrink, innocent as could be. And because I was on free care, you don't get appointments without intakes. And in intake, they ask you things like, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, yes, like, because I knew I was. Like, I'd been calling myself an alcoholic since I was 17. And I just, because I knew I drank like my daddy. So I just figured I would die early. And that'd be all right. I was okay with that. I had just gotten a little bit scared with this falling off the roof thing because it became apparent that, like, early didn't mean glamorous. Like, I could die early, but I didn't have a lot of control over how it was going to go down, and it really might hurt. But so here I was, an alcoholic, and they asked if I was on a relapse. And I said, why, yes, I was, because I had quit drinking for 9 months and because I had done something that even I couldn't stomach. And so I quit drinking for 9 months. And the way I quit drinking was to snort coke every day and, like, smoke weed from, like, dawn to dusk. But I had, in my mind, I had quit drinking. And I, you know, and but because I had picked back up, because I'd gotten into a fight with someone, I picked back up. I called that a relapse. So the shrink sees on the paper, alcoholic on relapse, and I've got this big gash in my head. And they couldn't, by the time I didn't go to the hospital when I cracked my head open. I tried to go to work the next day, and somebody picked me up off the road because I was still bleeding and obviously paler than I normally am. And they took me to the hospital. Beth Israel and I had a warm relationship by this time. And you know it's bad when the doctors gather around. So the doctors had gathered around, and they were looking at my head wound, which had been an open wound for 8 hours. So God knows how infected it might have gotten. So they just gave me a salve to rub in it. So here I am walking in the shrink's office. A couple hours later, I'm like, good, I can make my appointment. I walk into my meeting with my shrink and with my cracked open head. And she says, look, you know, I think that there's another problem here than your relationship. And if I were to give you therapy at this time, it's not clear to me it would work. We do have a detox here. And we do have a bed for you. It will be gone by Friday. And I said, thank you for the information. Went home and spread the booze that I had out from that Tuesday to that Friday, which means that Wednesday I had 2 40s of Budweiser spread out over the day. And Friday my last drink was a Colt 45, which I drank an inch at a time through the day just to try not to shake. My alcoholism, because I drank so early, I didn't really know anything about the emotional and spiritual and mental stuff because, I didn't have that. But the physical stuff was kind of obvious. When I was 14, I would shake in the night so bad that I would fall off my bed. So my solution to that was to take out the bed frame. And then I was still shaking and falling out and rolling. So I put like trash and clothes like all the way up to the bed. It was just a war zone in my room because I would flop all over it. And so I was still kind of having that. I was very physically sick when I went to that detox on that Friday. And I proceeded to throw up blood every day for my first year of sobriety. My alcoholism was not good looking. And I couldn't sleep. I slept maybe 2-3 hours a night. And I did not want to go to AA and deal with God. My social worker told me that some people go to AA just for the fellowship. And that you didn't have to work the steps. Which I guess technically is true. My first sponsor told me that if it not working, the steps are suggested, like the cord on a parachute is suggested. if you come fall out of a plane, you may choose to pull that cord. And that has, so I took that very seriously because I understood life and death very clearly. So I came to AA anyway with my friend Inga, who a couple weeks later tried to get me high on coke because we were all new, you know, and none of I don't have a class of friends I got sober with who I'm still sober with at all. I've got one kind of close from my home group now, Greenwich Village group, that when I moved to New York a year sober, he was just getting sober, and now he's got 17 years, and I'm like, newbie, so I've got that experience to some extent. He's probably my age. So I got here, and everyone felt older and squarer. I was in a band at the time. I was supporting myself with music because my drug dealing wasn't so good. So I was going to music school. I was playing in bands. People knew me on the street at the time, and I thought I was all that. And my sponsor had a baseball cap and a fanny pack, and she was from 5 feet tall from San Francisco. And really active in her Episcopal church, and a dyke. And she said she was 14 years sober. And I thought, everyone with 5 years or more, I thought that you were lying. You took a little nip every now and then. 14 years mostly, except for holidays. And I also thought that if it was true that you weren't drinking for 14 years straight, that you could not want alcohol the way I wanted alcohol. You know, I had physical cravings for alcohol around the clock every minute of the day when I got here. when I had a month, I would get like an hour a day reprieve, maybe, like literally an hour a day. When I was here 6 months, maybe an afternoon. When I was here, it took a year before I didn't physically want to drink alcohol for a day. And like maybe it took 5 years before, like now it's it before it 5 years, it became like occasional, like you get an occasional craving, like it's New Year's Eve or something bad's going on in my family, or and I would get like a hard craving. Now I get these kind of kinder, gentler, subtler cravings. So now, like, my alcoholism has morphed the form that it takes to attack me. That does not mean it is less powerful. So the I knew someone once who said, my alcoholism wants to kill me, and it's not personal, you know? It just, it wants me dead, you know? And the way it uses itself now I've got a really nice job, and I've got like a nice house, and I've got a beautiful wife, and I've got stuff, you know, and which is what I wanted. I did not want the promises. I wanted a house, a wife. So now I've got this stuff, right? And I've got this job, and at this job, people drink. And it's like way easier to be a transgender dyke than it is to be sober at my work, you know? And so, like, at work, like, they have cocktails, and they're expensive, like $20 I've never had a cocktail in my life. Like, I drank every day, and the way I drank it was like I had a cup like this with a little coffee in it, so you didn't know what it was, and the rest was Everclear. And like, I never drank out of, and this was before, now I know they've got fancy wines with a screw top. Mine all had screw top. It was, and my beer was like, I mentioned a couple of my favorites, but like, I didn't know any of this stuff. So it comes like that. It's like, I worked hard. Wouldn't a cocktail be nice? Like, I deserve a drink. It's like that. You know, and which is sort of like wanting a cookie. Like it's got about that amount of power. As long as I can work the steps hard and have a sponsor and sponsees and a home group and I'm doing service, it's like I want a cookie. It's not like it's coming after me wanting to kill me. And that's 18 years in. So I don't know if that's possible with 5 years. It wasn't for me. So I got to AA and joined Boston Crossroads on Tuesday nights, and that was a late meeting, and we had homeless folks in the back who smelled, and there were signs in the restroom that said, like, don't dye your hair in this sink, and and I felt like a fish out of water, but not because of them, but because of everybody who was clean. And I kept coming. When I got a year, someone suggested that I chair the beginners meeting. So I started doing that, and I've kind of done service ever since. I moved around a bit. I moved back to Memphis, which, I mean, I had to be in straight AA in Memphis as nothing else. But for me, they were more embracing than anywhere. Like, I felt more at home in my straight meetings in Memphis than I did in Yankeetown. So it was weird because they kind of got it. Like, they made me Santa for Christmas, like, which I thought was really something, because here, they're bringing their children. They didn't understand you can't be Christian and AA meeting at the same, like, that's not good. They didn't really get that Jesus couldn't come to the meeting. Like, so the meeting was called Traditions, and they hated giving money to the service structure, and we had Christmas parties, like Christmas and crucifixes, and so but they made me like Santa, so the kids like came, sat in my lap, and it was really interesting to me to like go home and fit was strange for me. A lot of people come to AA and get their families back. I came to AA and eventually pushed my family away entirely, which for me is recovery. And I'm sad about it. I love my drunk family, my drunk, violent, hateful family. And unfortunately, that taught me to love other hateful people, which I am still trying to get that impulse out of me. But I can't have any contact with my family now, and that's recovery for me. In Memphis, I found myself trying to, you know, they talk about living ninth step. I didn't really get, there is a point that, and I loved that living ninth step because it felt so sort of Christian and punitive. And I think it's true that we can't do the stuff we used to do. I can't. Like, I'm not meant to do the bad stuff I used to do, but this was beyond that. Like, this was, thank you. This was, it's Thanksgiving, so I bring the entire dinner. And after it's over, you wrap it up for my kid sister and nothing for me. And I don't say a word. Like, this was, I am a doormat. This was like, I will make everyone, when I moved out of there, I kept my kid sister in the house free for 6 years, which guess what she did to the house? You know, like, I didn't really get that the steps, ninth step stops. Like, once you make amends, that's it. Like, that's what we have the 10th step for, is if you keep screwing things up, you know? Like, I have found that I do have to live differently. But there's a part of the 9th step that I sort of skipped over in the big book where it says we make the best deal possible, like in our amends. I came back up to New York and rejoined Greenwich Village Group, where I'm now the program chair. I'm the treasurer for Manhattan. I'm the district chair for West Village and Soho. Like, I'm doing service. I have one sponsee, thank you, Jesus. And, and you know, that works for me. We actively work the steps. I do want to talk a little, speaking of Jesus, about working the steps, like, without a God. Because at first, when I was working the steps without a God, I sent a letter to GSO for my 7th step and asked GSO to remove my shortcomings. And I got a letter back from my higher power. It happened to come from a member of my home group I'm close to now. But I found, like, now that I'm later in sobriety, for me, I can say it took me a long time to figure out that the prayers wouldn't force me to believe in God. That, like, I could say the prayers out of the big book, and, like, Christianity wasn't contagious. But I have managed to stay sober and live what I believe is a productive life while still being an atheist. So when the big book says that the point of the big book is to show you a higher power, for me, that's been the process of recovery. And for me, it's been bigger than AA even, because AA has let me down. I have left AA meetings and wanted to die. Like, AA is not any more perfect for me than anyone is in AA. What it was like was, I just sort of lived in a physical body, had no contact with any sort of mental or spiritual or emotional anything. The physical body was about to die. That's what happened. And the way I healed it was to get in here. Living Sober, which is a pamphlet written by Barry L., who's was a member of our home group before he died. In the preface to it, it says that something, the American Medical Association says the primary treatment for alcoholism is not to drink. So, and that's what I got here. I got to not drink. This has not, acceptance has not solved all my problems. I still have problems, and they're big. I have problems other than alcohol, and I go places other than Alcoholics Anonymous to deal with them. What this has given me is a continuous sober life, which has given me the opportunity to make it what I want it to be, to put good people in my life, to break the patterns that I grew up with. And for that, I am forever grateful. That's all, God. Thanks.